Good morning. This is Talking About California, a KZYX series on issues of interest to Californians, and our guests will be Californians. I'm your host. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm director of the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit research and education center here on the coast. Our guest today is Chick Dabby Chinoy. She is director of the Asian and Pacific Islander Institute on Domestic Violence, based in San Francisco. The Asian and Pacific Islander Institute on Domestic Violence is a national, federally funded center which focuses on gender-based violence in Asian communities. Chick Dabby Chinoy was born in Bombay and lives in Berkeley. In between, she's lived in London, Cambridge, Paris, and Kathmandu.
She speaks Hindi, Gujarati, Marathi, and French.
And she's been working in this field for the last 28 years. Good morning, Chick. I hope I can call you Chick.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, good. Well, good morning. It's very nice to have you with us.
Good morning. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, I wondered if we could begin with just a little bit about yourself and your own interest in this work and your position at the Institute. And then perhaps we could move on to some questions of definition and some details of your project. So what about the Institute? Could you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. So the Asian and Pacific Islander Institute on Domestic Violence was established formally in 2000. And we're a national resource center. We provide training, consultation, technical expertise, and we do some research and data compilation, and we engage in policy advocacy. Our constituents, the folks we serve, include programs, domestic violence service programs that work with battered women. And we also work with all the systems professionals who are in the field. So we provide technical assistance and training to police officers, judges, attorneys, and just social workers, just lots of different folks across the systems.
And you're the director?
Yes, I'm the director there, and we're a very small staff of 5 people altogether, but we produce a lot of great work, and we have an excellent national reputation with our constituents and with the professional organizations. So our policy work involves collaborating with other national organizations.
And maybe just a word on how you came to be in the position of director and your personal or your own interests in the subject matter?
Sure. Well, essentially, when I first came to the U.S., I'm an immigrant here. I worked in the field of mental health, and I worked at an outpatient mental health clinic where we saw clients who were experiencing domestic violence. We saw batterers, so we had very early on, we had batterers intervention programs, and we also saw children exposed to maternal abuse. And so that's how I kind of got started in doing that work and moved, and that clinic was for all populations. It was based in Berkeley and then later in Oakland. And after that, I started working at a South Asian domestic violence organization called NARICA. And there we worked with women from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and provided a lot of direct services. So I was the executive director there. I wrote a lot of grants, did a lot of the community outreach, worked with an excellent team of South Asian women advocates. And then when the Institute started, I became the director of the Institute.
And the focus on Asian and Pacific Islanders, can you say a word about that? And
yes.
Possibly I know your work is national, but maybe you could tell us, if there are any specifics that relate to California, since that's kind of the topic of our program.
Absolutely. So the focus on Asians and Pacific Islanders is because of all the resource centers, there are 9 resource centers in the country that are funded by the Department of Health and Human Services, and they focus on specific topics like the criminal and legal issues affecting battered women. So some are focused on topics like child custody, civil and criminal, defense of battered women, etc. And then some are focused on populations. So our sort of sister organizations focus on domestic violence in the African American community, in the Latino community, and also in the Native Indigenous women groups. And so we focus on Asians and Pacific Islanders.
I see. And maybe you could tell us, a little bit about just who are Asians, and I hope it's not a stupid question, but who are Asians and Pacific Islanders and maybe in California?
Yes, and it's a good question because people have sort of narrow understandings of Asians and Pacific Islanders, like who fits in that category. And often Asians themselves have not necessarily included themselves or referred to themselves or identified with the Asian American label. So in California actually has the largest population of Asians in the country, and it's almost a third of the nation's total. So in California, 15% of the population are Asians. In San Francisco, 36%, so high concentration, obviously, in the San Francisco and Greater Bay Area. And in Mendocino, 2.5% of the population is Asian.
Well, you did your homework. And
I did my homework, and it's actually it's higher. So in Mendocino, white population is 80%.
Yeah.
African-American is 1.3, and Asian is 2.4. And then there are more, other breakdowns.
And so maybe it's kind of a geography question, but also could you say more specifically then who are Asians?
Right, yeah, I was going to do that.
Oh, sorry.
So the largest group of Asians in California, and in descending order, so you have Filipinos who are the largest group, followed by Vietnamese, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and Asian Indians, people from India. But then there are whole other groups of Asians. Asia is sort of half the world, so it's a huge continent, and includes of the immigrants who are in California, there are a lot of refugees coming from West Asia, from the war in Iraq, and there are refugees coming from Central Asia from the wars in Afghanistan. In addition, the Pacific Islanders are all the folks in the territories, in the U.S. territories and in Hawaii. So the California, I think, has one of the largest groups of Pacific Islanders on the mainland. Obviously, the largest numbers are in the Pacific. But on the mainland and in Southern California, there are large concentrations of Pacific Islanders.
So mentioning the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, it must, I suppose, the Vietnamese population also includes refugees from war and probably the Philippine population as well. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, actually, war refugees are, come into the country for years and years. So in Laos, there were a lot of Hmong refugees, and they're still coming. 30 years later, 30 plus years later, the refugees are still coming. People have been in camps for decades. So even the Iraq refugees, all these other war refugees, will keep coming, trickling in over the years. refugees from Bhutan. There's recently been a huge resettlement of refugees, Bhutanese refugees who actually grew up in and were in camps in Nepal. So most of them, you know, speak Nepali rather than Bhutanese even.
And do these people tend to live in concentrated communities, or are they scattered throughout the state? How does that work, and how do you deal with the issues of language?
Yeah, they do live in concentrated communities. It's partly when they first come as refugees. It depends where they're resettled by the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And then it also depends a little bit on occupation and what they prefer. So the Hmong settled in Central Valley as farmers, but sometimes there are lots of secondary migrations. So, you know, they may initially settle in Minnesota and Wisconsin, but then they move to California, or then they, you know, or in the other direction. So there are a lot of factors that go into where refugees are settled, but there certainly is, you know, sort of politics of agglomeration, people finding solidarity near communities that they know, or already established communities. The language issue is a big one. It affects all kinds of services, not just services around domestic violence. When refugees first come and they rely on interpreters that are provided to them, once they're settled here, and then immigrants in general also, some immigrants are not proficient or fluent in English and need interpretation.
And I was going to ask you later, but maybe now is a better time. Are there issues of documentation and so forth, legality, as far as these groups of immigrants are concerned, the way that there are with immigrants from Mexico and Central America?
It's hard to say, to have accurate data. As you might know, there's a lot of speculative data. I don't actually have the data about, you know, what the stats are for undocumented immigrants for coming from Asia. But, for instance, there's a lot of trafficking. And, you know, traffickers bring smuggle people through all kinds of borders. So you may have Asians coming
through. So tell traffickers, would you just go back 1 second?
Yeah.
And tell us what traffickers are.
Trafficking refers to the practice of smuggling people across borders. So it involves the element of what's called human smuggling, and transporting people across borders, putting them to work in very exploitative conditions, creating systems of debt. So where traffickers are paid vast amounts to bring people across borders. And a lot of times trafficked victims are put to work in the sex trade or in exploitative labor conditions, in mm-hmm. factories, etc. So with the, you know, with California being that with trafficked individuals coming into the country and coming into California, you're just going to have people who are not documented.
I mean,
I'd really urge us to think about poor immigrants and as economic refugees. You know, it takes a lot to leave your home country and home and your family behind. So there are very strong push conditions that push people out of their environments, mostly economic conditions. And then, of course, there are pull conditions. So, you know, immigration is always understood on this continuum of push and pull factors.
Does that relate to who gets in and who doesn't?
It does. And so from war zones, yes, so in terms of poor immigrants, who come in undocumented, they are fleeing rather desperate conditions at home, either economic conditions or political conditions, and sometimes the two can't be separated. Sometimes they're fleeing, economic degradation because of disasters or conflict. And so then they're one group that come in, but oftentimes it's the middle classes and sometimes the upper classes that also come in from those kind of areas because it's so dangerous to be there, you know, and so they also flee and come in maybe as asylum seekers or political refugees.
Hmm. Well, very interesting, but I think we should really turn to what is the heart of your work, and that is the subject of domestic violence. And I know you've told me there's actually a lot of confusion about what exactly domestic violence is. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you think it is. Give us some help with our definitions and vocabularies, but also in terms of your institute and your work. Could you do that?
Yes. And that's a very good question to start with. I'd like to clarify that domestic violence is really a pattern of abusive behavior, and it is used to cause harm and to humiliate and to create a climate of fear. In addition, of course, with domestic violence, there are resulting physical injuries, there are long-term health problems, there are short and long-term mental health problems, and then there are a lot of other social ramifications that come out of that pertain to domestic violence. Child custody, homicide, etc. But I won't go into those now. So I really want to emphasize that domestic violence is a pattern of behavior, and that involves physical violence, sexual violence, high amounts of sexual violence, actually, and economic control, controlling resources, household income, etc., and also a lot of emotional abuses and coercion. So there's one way of looking at domestic violence, which is looking at both at all the sort of physical harms that arise out of all these four types of violence, you know, the physical harms that arise out of physical, sexual, economic, and emotional abuse. But there are also vast elements of coercive control. So sometimes it may not be any physical beating, but lots of threats that are either veiled or explicit. And I can think of an example of an explicit threat where a woman was telling about how her husband on their first wedding anniversary came home, you know, very cheerful and said, oh, and he had a great wedding anniversary gift for her, and it was downstairs in the garage, and so he wanted her to come down to look at the gift. And so she was all excited, anticipating, obviously, a car, but it was a coffin.
A coffin?
A coffin. So he had bought a coffin and brought it home and parked it in the garage. And that's a veiled threat, that if I can't control you, this is what your fate would be. So just think of the message that kind of action sends to somebody, how chilling that is. And you don't necessarily have any evidence of physical abuse in that case. And again, it's not just one incident. It's a pattern of incidents.
And maybe some one or two other examples that might of perhaps the not so apparent type that although there is the beating and so forth, isn't there?
Yes, there's beating, and before I just give an example, I also want to differentiate between abuse and violence and couples conflict everyone has conflict in their relationships. And people, you know, can say stupid things, say hurtful things, do stupid things, make mistakes. And not all conflicts are resolved in a very kind of amicable way. But there is a difference between couples conflict and abuse. And the difference is, as I said, a pattern and also an intention to cause, you know, physical and emotional injury. Other examples, yes, indeed, physical abuse. There's a whole range of things. It isn't just hitting or slapping, but it can include, you know, being pushed against the wall, being denied adequate food, so, you know, being starved, not allowed to go anywhere, so being very tightly controlled and, you know, restricted movements. It can involve strangulation, which most people often call choking, but attempted strangulation is very frequently reported in domestic violence cases by women. And so those are some of the kinds of examples around physical abuse. It can, around sexual violence, there's a whole range of behaviors. Again, a lot of coercive control, women being forced to have sex against their will, being forced to watch and mimic pornography, acting out very violent pornographic scenes, and, you know, instances where children are forced to watch, or men who pimp their partners out on a regular basis. So there's lots of different forms of sexual abuse. And it's not generally just one thing. There's often a sort of convergence of some of these issues. In fact, there's data to show that women who are women who are victims of physical and sexual violence in an intimate relationship are at 7 times greater risk of being killed by their abusers.
This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. This is today's program is Talking About California. And today we're speaking with Chick Dabby Chinoy, and she's the director of the Asian and Pacific Islander Institute on Domestic Violence, and she's based in San Francisco. And we've gotten into a very disturbing subject here, but an extremely important subject. You said that listeners might need to know something about the actual data. And did you mean by that how widespread these kinds of problems are?
Yes. And I have some distressing statistics, of course. So there's data both at the national level and California. If I may just start with the national data for a moment. And this was a study done by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and it used a survey method in 2010. And it's a very, very good study that just recently they compiled and analyzed the data and released the report. And the national statistics show this is all forms of violence, so not just focusing on domestic violence, but in terms of rape, 1 in 5 women report being raped in their lifetime, and 1 in 71 men report being raped. Of the 1 in 5 women who were raped, only 15% report being raped by a stranger. So most of them had some contact or some, you know, acquaintanceship. Either they had an intimate partner relationship, or they were acquaintances, or they knew their rapist. And 42% of women are raped before the age of 18. Of the 1 in 71 men who are...
Sorry, Chick, 42%, that's almost half.
Yep.
Half of women, you said,
are raped before the age of 18. And of the 1 in 71 men who are raped in their lifetime, 28% are raped before the age of 10.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Stalking. So stalking is the behavior of, determinedly following and monitoring people's movements. A lot of technologies now are there to assist stalkers, and we all know about some of, in addition, of course, to the social network sites and et cetera, all these technologies have the, kind of double-edged, are double-edged in their advantages and disadvantages, of course. So stalking is experienced by 1 in 6 women nationwide and 1 in 19 men. And primarily stalking is by intimate partners. And then when we look at the data on domestic violence, severe physical violence is experienced by 1 in 4 women during their lifetime and 1 in 7 men. And with the data on men, there isn't a distinction in the statistics yet in the reports on whether they are heterosexual men or homosexual men. Mm-hmm. So we can't assume that when we see data about men that that they're all in opposite sex relationships and that their perpetrators are women.
Right. And so these are national, but not so different from California, would you say?
Yeah, in California, the domestic violence figures show that 40% of Californian women experience domestic violence in their lifetime, so a little higher than the national numbers, which was 1 in 4 women. And their rates of domestic violence are higher amongst 18 to 24-year-olds and amongst pregnant women.
Hmm. And I wonder, I suppose the question's inevitable, are the ethnic differences of significance for us at all? And you mentioned that the institutes and study groups often focused on different ethnic groups.
Yes. The differences in data are arrived at in many ways. I mean, there are several ways to analyze, of course, the methodology of how the data is collected, rebounds to the conclusions and the numbers. And when we look at, data in Asian populations, so there aren't large national surveys that have a breakdown of Asian populations. I mean, the total Asian population in the country is around 5%. They're not going to get sampled in large numbers. And when we look at the data on domestic violence in Asian populations, we look at small studies that are done by academics, or done, data in unpublished dissertations, et cetera. And so we look at both published and unpublished research that are in more community-based studies. And the data there shows a range of 41 to 61% of Asian women report domestic violence in their lifetime.
And so just to go back and reiterate something again that I think you said was important, that in thinking about these statistics, then we're really thinking about more than just outbursts and anger. Am I right in that?
Yes, we're not talking about single incidents. And these data are collected by interviews, face-to-face interviews, samples, questionnaires, all kinds of different mixed methodologies. And what you're referring to is sometimes what's called incidence data, so how many police reports there are, And the incidence data, how many times, it's hard to tell exactly sometimes. It's a combination of two things. It's people being emboldened to report. So sometimes there's an increase in the reporting, which makes the numbers go up, and sometimes there's an actual increase in the domestic violence. So after, for example, this is an old example, which might date me, but after the O.J. Simpson killings and the during the trial, you know, a lot of women reported being really scared because their partners were saying they would juice them or Nicole them or etc. And so, and the incidence of violence went up, and women reported it too because there's just a fear, and you know, it's a different kind of mindset that then people are willing to come forward and report the abuse. Or there might be greater calls. You know, there's more public awareness of the problem, so then our reporting increases.
Well, to shift a little bit, I wonder if this is another difficult and very big question, but where does this come from? What would you think you could help us with in terms of the origins of gender-based violence or domestic violence? Do you deal with those kinds of problems, very difficult in your institutional work?
Yes, we do. And, you know, the battered women's movement and the anti-domestic violence movement has been around close to 40 years now. And we really focused initially on looking at the experiences of violence, validating women's experiences and understanding the depth of the problem, and then providing resources and recourses, so social services, legal interventions, etc., for the problem of domestic violence. We have in our focus on resources and information also, of course, kept trying to understand the causes, but they're harder to tackle, and they change as well. For many of us in the field, we really look at the issue of patriarchy and patriarchal power relationships as being the cause of gender-based violence and gender oppression. And I want to clarify what I mean by patriarchy. So patriarchy is about the maintaining the status quo of power in relationships. And it really cuts across all kinds of relationships. It's relationships between men and men, women and women, and women and men. So patriarchy should not be narrowly understood as just, you know, men's oppression of women. It is really about keeping the status quo of power in all arenas. And power doesn't rely on just one axis of identity. So people don't have just power just because they're white or because they're men. So it's, you know, our various identities give us power or disempower us, exclude us from the larger mainstream that holds on to power, or, you know, exclude us from the ruling class that holds on to power. So this gender oppression really becomes an expression of male domination and power. And then women's roles in that are also to uphold and reinforce those structures of inequality.
And how does
the women do the bidding of patriarchy as well?
And how does that happen?
Well, a lot of times when we, at a very concrete level, when there's a domestic violence situation going on in a family, people will support the batterer by victim blaming, by blaming the victim. You know, so many communities engage in pretty grotesque levels of victim blaming. You know, saying that women deserved it, it was their fault. If they were only better, this wouldn't happen to them, etc. There are instances where, after a rather horrifying domestic violence incident, where a batterer attacked his ex-wife and her parents, who were running a business in the store, and used a knife and really did very, very serious harm to all of them. The community took up a collection, but the money was to bail him out, not to help the family with their medical expenses. So,
and why do you think it, maybe just why could that happen? What was the?
It happens because people feel that batterers have somehow been wronged, or they are entitled to what they did. So impunity, entitlement gets supported by communities, by families. And many times family members, male and female family members, also engage in victim blaming and upholding batterers upholding male privilege and impunity.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes we get the idea that patriarchy is just really a given. It's always been with us. It always will be. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think with all the emphasis on income inequality as a result of the bank's failure and their quick recovery and the support they got to enable that recovery, and then the impunity which they, shrugged off their responsibility to the populace, those are examples of patriarchy that still, that take different routes, but essentially, in some fundamental way, they stay stable. So the expressions of patriarchy or the avenues for it to be expressed might change. Mm-hmm. And the disproportionality with which power is exercised might change.
And class, sometimes class and patriarchy are counterposed. Do you have an idea on that?
Around inequality in general?
And control and power.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why I was saying that, identity doesn't, power doesn't rest on just one axis of identity. So, being your class position certainly confers a lot of power and class has been very apparent and in play, and I think getting some visibility finally, because many times Americans forego the analysis of class, but I think the economic crisis and the behavior of the banks and of the financiers has really revealed what those class differences actually mean. And so, for example, with money, I mean, the understanding that sometimes sometimes wealth and income are conflated, right? So people feel that if you can keep earning more, then that gives you a certain status, which of course it does, and gives you certain mobility, which is indeed correct. But there's, in addition to that, what the ruling class and the uber wealthy have is a huge collection, a huge, foundation of wealth to fall back on.
So I wanted to say one more time that this is KZYX. Our program today, this morning, is talking about California, and our guest is Chick Dabby Chinoy, and she's the director of the Asian and Pacific Islander Institute on Domestic Violence, which is based in San Francisco. And Chick, it's again obvious, it seems to me, that you see your work focused on domestic violence, but also part of a larger concern with social justice. And as listening to you, it seems as if domestic violence flows over into and relates to and connects to all sorts of other social issues and problems. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's been one of the major achievements, actually, both of the anti-domestic violence movement and, you know, of the women's movement in general, is the ability to connect a certain aspect of gender oppression or gendered harms and see how it's connected to other kinds of injustices.
Let me, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but tell us a bit about the word gender, just in case we have listeners who are still confused about why this word gender, and then, but don't forget where we were.
Okay. Well, gender refers to the process of socialization, of how and social roles that are expected of men and women. And over the years, with all the focus on identity and sexual orientation and gender orientation, it now also, from the LGBT movements, has made clear that gender identity is on a spectrum. So we don't just have a kind of clear-cut notion of men and women or female roles and male roles or female expectations and male expectations, but that there is a sort of continuum along which they shift, and referring to both socialization, male and female socialization, referring to sexual orientation, gender preference, gender identities, sexual preference, etc. So it's really a sort of combination of these various factors, and the scrutiny of identity and subjectivity in the last few years that has, I mean, in the last few decades, excuse me, that has really resulted in paying more attention to the notion of gender rather than just saying, you know, referring to sex and just male and female.
So thank you, but I interrupted you, but to come back, we were talking about social justice and the accomplishments
right.
of the women's movement.
Yeah, so, you know, these movements have, we've been able to look at a particular kind of harm that's, say, caused to women, and since we're talking about domestic violence, we'll use that, but then what are the other resulting, or if you like, collateral damage that occurs, you know. So more than 50% of homeless women are homeless because of domestic violence. So then we understand that you need to focus on housing as an issue for poor women or and homeless women and women on the streets. We see the issue of economic impoverishment and poverty, and how that doesn't just affect battered women or women who are victims and survivors of sexual and domestic violence, but it affects so many women, poor women. If you look at the data on how families spend their money, women spend over 90% of their income on the family, and men spend about 40% of their income on the family. So then you connect it to, like, where do you put the money, who gets the loans, who gets the, you know, access to credit cards, etc., and how are people going to spend it? So if you want to lift the family out of poverty, it's a better investment to make your microloans or your business loans to women. So those are kind of examples of how you connect by looking at certain kinds of oppressions, and then you kind of connect them up to other arenas of social justice.
And you also mentioned to me, for instance, two things you mentioned, HIV and child custody. Maybe you
right.
can explain to our listeners why you included those.
Yeah, and I mean, the whole arena of health professionals and, you know, training health professionals to understand the effects of domestic violence has been really a very successful prevention strategy. So if you just look at HIV, one of the problems we're looking at, and which actually the White House advisor on violence against women is also just established a federal roundtable to look at this issue, which is the convergence of HIV infection risk and domestic violence. And all over the world, people have seen that infection rates have increased dramatically for women. Women are the highest group of new infections, HIV infections. And they stay in monogamous, married, or, you know, partnered relationships, heterosexual relationships, and they still get infected. So you have to be able to analyze why that's happening and then provide the prevention services that are targeted to women and also provide the medications that would improve their conditions. So part of what we end up in our movement having done very successfully is show those linkages and then point the way to interventions and prevention strategies. And I just want to make a comment about custody, which is that in, you know, many women who are physically and sexually abused by their intimate partners are ending up losing custody of their children because of increased sort of batterer manipulation, of batterers claiming that their partners are the abusers, falsely accusing them of child abuse, etc. So this is a big area where we are really struggling to bring in some justice for women.
Even though the popular idea out there seems to be that the poor man always loses in the custody dispute. So you're saying that's not so clear?
No, that's not. I don't think there's much evidence to that to indicate that. And with domestic violence, we're even hearing about attorneys, et cetera, telling their clients not to bring up domestic violence because it will hurt the custody case. You know, whereas before, it would have been important to raise that issue. People are now trying to not to disclose it because they're just seen as making allegations and false allegations of domestic violence to win custody or something.
Hmm. I wanted to, before we are finished today, to talk a bit, to return to your institute and the kind of practicalities of the work that you do, but I can't help asking you to comment on something else that's on your website. And I should say, by the way, that the we haven't said this, I apologize. We're talking about the Asian and Pacific Islander Institute on Domestic Violence, and you can find a wealth of information on their website, www.apiidv.org. Does that sound right to you?
Yep.
Yeah, and so that's easy to find, very interesting, but I was looking at it just before this interview, and I noticed emphasis on some statistics, women being half the population in the world, yet doing two-thirds of the work, receiving one-tenth of the income and owning one-hundredth of the property. Can this be true, Chick Dabby?
Yeah, but you know, that data is from the 1970s. It's from a UN report.
Yeah.
And I don't think, you know, that data is still cited. I'm always looking for the newer calculus of those figures, but that's pretty much, yeah. And I think, if anything, you know, that inequity and inequality have increased and sharpened.
Hmm. So you really are attacking a monumental problem here, and of course it should go without saying on the program that we should begin with recognizing the bravery, the courage that has to be involved in people tackling problems like this. But so tell us, maybe for the we have maybe 10 minutes left here. Tell us maybe in some detail about what people are doing to challenge these kinds of problems, to confront these kinds of problems. And maybe is there some hope? You could tell us if there have been any positive outcomes that you know of.
Okay. All right. Yes, I think there's good outcomes. I think let's just start with the most extreme issue of homicide, domestic violence-related homicide. So there are police departments, especially in Maryland, that have been conducting lethality assessments and have brought down the rate of homicide by 10 percentage points every year for 4 years now. So homicide rates...
And how have they done that?
The police officers conduct a lethality assessment on the spot when they are called to a home. So most times, you know, they're looking at evidence, looking for probable cause to make an arrest, offering resources, etc. In addition, they are now doing an assessment of whether the woman is at risk of being killed by her abuser.
Okay.
So that's one example. Another example I want to give is in the health arena. And, you know, so many health professionals have been trained to identify and ask about domestic violence. So we, for instance, the IOM, which is the Institute of Medicine, has recommended that all women get screened for domestic violence every year, and that screening is done without charge to them. So many of us have been working on the kinds of questions, the kinds of screening questions that would invite disclosure or invite, you know, the correct information rather than scare people off and have them, you know, clam up or feel fearful of their safety. So the Institute of Medicine's recommendation is really an important landmark in terms of recognizing that this issue has very deleterious health and mental health effects and that we can start to address them.
And the recommendations would be to providers?
Yes, to health providers. And then health providers are working on the kinds of questions that would, you know, be appropriate to ask. That would be a screening question.
In the way that they do with children, I suppose, in CPS?
Yes, and the way they do with children. But if you look at health professions, professionals, there's so much training now that looks at this. Let me just give you one example that most people don't even think about, which is dentists. You know, why would dentists be trained about domestic violence or child sexual abuse? Because what they find is that children who, especially, I mean, adult patients who were molested as children are really re-traumatized by going to the dentist because they're lying down flat. There's a light overhead. Somebody's putting something into their mouth. They can't say anything. And they have no control of what's happening to them. And if you were a victim of child sexual assault, this would be a very scary and traumatizing experience. So dentists are trained to recognize that patients who cancel a lot of appointments, this might be what's happening. This may be why. And how to then work with patients who have these past histories.
And you have a very small staff.
Right.
How do you manage?
Okay, so then the one piece I do want to emphasize is the incredible community organizing that programs engage in. So all our programs, we're not just providing services. Of course, the social services, legal services, custody-related services, all these things are incredibly important. In addition, you have to change people's attitudes. You have to change social norms. You have to change impunity. You have to change systems practices. And there's incredible levels of community organizing in in the Asian populations. I mean, Hmong advocates work with the Klan Council to change their attitudes, confront. Sometimes you have to confront leadership, the typical sort of community leaders who are extremely conservative.
Could you just fill us in on that? When and where are we talking about? Do you have some detail on that?
Yeah, in all the communities here in California, I mean, we look, since we work specifically with Asian populations, I know a lot about them, but I also know that, you know, this is being done in all communities, in African American, in white, in all communities, there's such a strong emphasis on organizing and getting the word out about domestic violence, getting the word out about resources, and providing, you know, getting the word out about how it affects children, how it affects communities. There's a lot of work being done on elder abuse, for instance, which is a huge hidden problem, too. So I think that that's the very critical piece of any movement, is to do this organizing and to remind us that movements are about liberation. You know, it's not only to push back on injustice, but the purpose of the pushing back on those injustices, of changing social structure and power structures, is to have a liberatory agenda, which is good for everybody, you know, benefits everyone.
One last thing. I think there's we have a kind of a contradictory situation thinking about immigrants in particular. We've talked about immigrants quite a bit. On the one hand, the sort of today the issues of fear of ICE and Lemigre and so forth and so on. And yet you feel that there's a positive place for government in this work. Could you finish up with just a point on that?
With the efforts at the governmental level?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think this current administration is very focused on preventing domestic violence, sexual violence, teen violence, what used to be called teen dating violence, but, you know, teens don't date that much anymore. So the Vice President, Joseph Biden, authored the Violence Against Women Act, and he has now, so now there is a White House advisor on violence against women who is located in his office, and there's a White House Council on Women and Girls. And the White House Council on Women and Girls looks at all kinds of issues affecting gender equity and inequality, and not just on doesn't just look at violence. And all the federal agencies have to look at how the policies of their federal departments affect can boost gender equity. So that's been a very important consideration in California, in San Francisco. You know, there have been success. Different people in political office have, again, paid close attention to the issue of domestic violence, ensuring that there are adequate services. For instance, the San Francisco jails actually have a batterer intervention program for people in jail so that they get the help whilst they're there. And they're not, you know, so there's some rehabilitation that goes on. There's attending to people's trauma and the harm that men have experienced as well, that violence causes to so many of us. Yeah.
Well, I think we have to call this discussion to a close now. It's been extremely interesting, quite disturbing as well. I should remind listeners that we've been talking with Chick Dabby Chinoy, who's the director of the Asian and Pacific Islander Institute on Domestic Violence, which is located in San Francisco. And you can find out more about her work on the Institute website, which is www.apiidv.org. With that, Chick, thank you very much for coming, spending an hour talking with us. And I'm sure listeners will join me in applauding your work and your courage in doing it. And so I'll have to say goodbye.
Okay, and thank you very much for your interest in this topic.
Okay, thanks, Chick. And I'll remind listeners that our program, Talking About California, will come back next week, same time, 9 o'clock on Thursday. And thanks for listening, and good morning.